find the site. I will help to put that in. Can we take it to a head with our long time? That takes us to the section one. I want us to discuss section one together with section three, because those two go together. I want us to talk together. We are there addressing the same issue. Section one, amendment of section five of section 37. And across on page three, amendment of section 11 of section 37. I'm saying if you can take those two because they speak to each other. That is the one and the three.
Yes, that's technically.
Yeah.
Why don't we always continue your amendment in your proposal?
Yeah.
You use clause. Why don't you say that clause one?
Clause one. Yeah. Yeah. Do I say therefore clause one and clause three?
Yeah.
Yeah. Any proposal for clause one?
That's a question.
Yeah.
Okay. We look at the admission.
Yeah.
One question which runs through the what is the reason for eliminating the original from the original statute? The stakeholders were supposed to be included in the contract. Because the reasoning, the argument is by omitting those, in fact, you are saying that it is coming what you are arguing that this is a way of excluding them. Of course, here now, this new clause only mentioned at the counter.
Yeah.
I would, before we pause an amendment, or the next to go back to tell us the reason for specifically including the rest of the constitution.
Yeah. Maybe that's a fair question. Just allow the sergeant if you want to speak to that.
First of all, I apologize to Director General. You won't join us because the moment is delayed in the meeting with the minister. Here, there are some specific aspects. It is a situation that the position has to be in the current legislature. Section 5 of the National Education Policy that when you make policy, the minister makes policy, the minister must consult with a long list of bodies recognized by the minister for their purpose. And that in the constitution of the NEPC, it is also then carried forward. And there's a link between the section 5 and the body, and the body in, and those that should by regulation then be included in the membership of the NEPC. We've seen in the provincial example of the Gauteng. That the body of education is eventually all the competency, all the various category of role players, it becomes a very big and unwielding body which makes it very difficult to operate and very ineffective. The approach with this is
that's I don't know if they were able to record what they're saying. Are you able to have that? Can you move? And we assume that for now you are an honorable member.
Yeah,
is this the mic? We're trying as much as our archives to capture whatever we're saying. so that we another component I made was trying to get more information from the authorities, because mainly people, especially the communions and organized, were saying this amendment is leaving them out. And the question that the honorable chairman was trying to get compliance, even before we vote one way or the other, that's one of the things. Why is it that the department wants to exclude the and maybe you could even go so far as to say, why do you want us to enact something that is unconstitutional?
Thank you, Chairperson and honorable members, and I apologize to the Minister. Certainly we're not proposing anything I believe that is unconstitutional. We've done a lot of research and received a lot of advice on this particular matter, not just from the internal people, but from senior advocates in a number of areas. And certainly I don't believe there's anything unconstitutional that we're proposing here. Yeah, I think this is one of those things that essentially one learns from experience around things that you do in legislation, and I think it's appropriate after a period of time to look at what has happened and see if there's any lessons we can learn, and therefore if there are any changes that need to be made. And I think we have an instance here, Chair, of such a provision. And, you know, the House would be aware that there has been a provision for an NECC in previous legislation. The National Education Policy Act provided for it, but for a number of reasons, and I don't think it's appropriate for you to go into those at this stage, this NECC has, as you're aware, never in fact been established. And I think it's really based on that particular history that we said, let's understand the reasons why perhaps it hasn't been established, and let's try and fix those up and make this a workable structure that in fact can serve the purpose for what it was originally intended. So let us be quite clear, Chair. There's nothing in this legislation that is suggesting that we will not establish a National Education and Training Council. In fact, it is our very, not ours, it's our Minister's determination to establish such a council. But what we want to be sure is that when we do set up such a council, that it would be appropriately formed, that it would have the kind of composition and functions that would be appropriate, and therefore in a sense that it would be a working body which is in fact able to give the kind of advice to the Minister that probably is required. And I think it's true to say, if you look at the former legislation and the way that the NECC was constructed, it would probably, with the benefit of hindsight, almost have been obvious to us that this thing probably couldn't have worked and would not have been able to give the advice we would have required. So, Chair, what we've done now is crafted a different wording around the establishment of the NECC. It still does talk about the establishment of it, but it is less cumbersome, less specific in terms of the exact representation on that committee, that council, the roles, functions, etc. And what we've done is proposed a wording now that leaves some of that more open, more able to respond to the specific issues that the Minister might be requiring advice on. And the three aspects I think that we have moved on. It's firstly to say we have not listed, as we did in the previous legislation, the actual structures that should be there. We listed them one by one by one, and that might have been appropriate at the time, but given the reorganization and reshuffling of the way these bodies are organized, we think that the listing of particular organizations is not appropriate. But I must stress, Chair, and this is where the Section 1 together with 3 are important to read together, it talks about a consultation with such appropriate consultative bodies as have been established. Now, Chair, if there is a major constituency that has an interest and a bearing on a particular issue, I don't believe it would take any sort of legal action to say if this was done without the participation of that particular organization or sector, then clearly that's inappropriate. You can't make policy around teachers if you're not going to involve teachers in the consultative structure. You can't make policy around school governance if you don't involve school governing bodies. So all the constituencies that would be looking for representation where it would be appropriate are certainly still going to be in this body, there's no doubt. But the issue is whether it's appropriate here to get a full set of representative structures. We have, for example, in the country, 5 national teacher organizations. Now, I think it's a very real question. Do you allow each of them to have a representative? And if so, you're going to get also into the contestation about is that representation proportional to size or not, to big organizations, that more or less. So these kind of things, if you tie them down in legislation, are very difficult, Chair. And the truth is also, if they are going to come as representatives of organizations, then you really get hampered. It's very difficult for a council to take decisions when every time you want to raise something, no, we don't have a mandate on this thing, you take time to go back, you come back, and then the organization says, but this is our mandated position. And someone might have a mandate on another position, you're stuck. What you want is a council, and be careful here, it's not just an expert council, but we want a council that would have, for example, proper representation of the teaching community broadly, but a council that was also able, on its own, to take what, outside of organizational interest, what is the best interest for education, to give advice to the minister. I don't want to know what is in the best interest of a particular teacher organization or governing body. I want to know what the minister wants to know, what's in the best interest of education. And that's where you need to deal with people.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah,
so,
I'm demoting
will include all legitimate constituencies. We will include them in a way that enables the council to properly consider matters and to be able to come together and give a consistent piece of advice to the minister, advice that quite clearly would be in the bigger interest of education rather than of any one particular organisation. So that's the only change that's proposed here, Chair. We're certainly not, as I say, just establishing an NECC or anything like that. We're simply saying there's a different way of doing this, and we think in this case it's a better way of doing it. I hope I've covered it.
Okay, I'm
okay. Thank you, Chair. I think it was clear in the hearing that the problem pretty much lies with the word may rather than shall in section 11. And the argument is that if the NEC hadn't been established in these past 3 years with the word must, why would we believe that it would be established with the word may? I mean, it doesn't make sense. And the fact that it came up pretty clearly that most of the stakeholders felt that the issues in the amendment bill wouldn't be issues if an NECC had functioned as an advisory body. And so it just seemed a great pity to have come this far with a document that most of the stakeholders couldn't buy into in any way and really felt that their input would have been valuable, and if not their input, the input of an NECC or the advice of an NECC would have been relevant. And the emphasis, of course, was on the advisory. So just to bring that in.
Chair, I think the explanation by the DG is quite satisfactory. We noted in the public hearing various input that referred to this matter of ensuring representation. I know the Catholic Institute of Education talked about representative participation and not to only allow the minister to make new policy unilaterally. And I think in terms of the DG's explanation, it really takes care of that point. just from the side of the ANC, given that particular assurance that we've received, we are quite satisfied with the clause as it stands, and will not be proposing any changes to the clause. But it's clearly been explained in the records of this meeting that there will be representative participation, and that some of the fears that were expressed at the public hearings are quite clearly unfounded. So we are quite happy from the side of the ANC to leave the floor as it stands. Thank you, Chair.
I wanted to speak to you before, just to address the constitutionality part of that. That it is even near discussion of this bill, which has not gone before the MPC, is actually a waste of time.
Chairperson, can I defer to my legal advisor at
yes, maybe. Go ahead.
The issue of if I understood the position on the unconstitutionality, it is based on the fact that the NEPA provided for a procedure if I understood the argument raised by the various parties making presentation, the argument goes that the NEPA provides for a specific process for making legislation, and which is not followed because of the NEPC that has not been established. And because of that, it is unconstitutional because it does not comply with the constitutional principle of the fair administrative justice principle. Here, there is a few flaws in that argument which need to be considered. The first one, and I don't know if the Honourable Members got copies of the NEPA legislation, the NEPA Act, the National Education Policy Act, that it is a fact that the legislation provides for two different aspects. The third thing that one must also take into account is that the National Education Policy Act is only dealing with policy made by the minister as educational policy. It's not dealing with government policy, which is in white paper. It is not dealing with any other policy other than policy specifically made by the minister in terms of the National Education Policy Act. Another aspect, if the minister makes policy in terms of the National Education Policy Act, and it is currently with, then the role players, as is provided for in Section 5, must be consulted. And there's a specific list of role players that is part of that process. But if you turn to Section 6, which is dealing with consultation on legislation, there's a different set of role players that must be consulted. Because legislation is not in the domain of the minister. The minister is not making legislation. The parliament is making legislation. The minister merely bring a proposal, a bill, and table it in Parliament, for Parliament to take it further and take the final decision on that. And in that case, the National Education Policy Act requires consultation with the Council, and the definition of Council here is not the NEPC, but it is the Council of Education Ministers, which is referred to in this definition. And it requires that if it is related to labour issues, then also the party aren't represented in the ELRC. But here, that is the only list of categories when the minister takes legislation to Parliament which need consultation. There's no reference to any NETC consultation, there's no reference to any other consultation, to any other role player. Here, but it's also important, when we look at the this piece of legislation that is currently before this committee, where is it coming from? There is no policy made by the minister which impinge on the provisions of any of the clauses in the bill. It is dealing with, first of all, the NETC, the composition, which is the source thereof, is the national or the NEPA, which is an act of parliament, and it was in any event the source document, which is the bone of contention, that is not based on policy and made by the minister, but it is based on the white paper one, a government policy, which requires that there must be policy instrument or policy framework within policy, that policy being made in the education system. The next issue that the bill addresses is that of norms and standards of the school. There's no policy made by the minister on it. It is in terms of the constitutional provision to make norms and standards, minimum norms and standards, and also in terms of the Schools Act, the requirement to deal with it in terms of White Paper 2, which is dealing with the governance and structure of a public and well, the school sector in general.
Yes.
It also deals with the issue of the functions of the principal. Once again, there's no policy being made by NEPA which underpins that provision. Once again, it's coming from White Paper 2. Here it also deals with the underperforming schools. There's no policy made by the minister in terms of NEPA that underpins the provision. It's once again flowing from White Paper 2. Here, the argument, therefore, that it must be referred back to the NETC for their consideration is totally unfounded, because there is no policy which form the basis made by the minister who is carrying through. It is based on policy made by government in two white papers, White Paper 1 and White Paper 2, which form the basis of the South African Schools Act, and through that act, the necessary changes were made. So here, it is a further aspect which also very important to consider, is the fact that the process of lawmaking is an administrative issue and must comply with internal processes as the Constitutional Court provided in the three health cases, health legislation. There is no principle or rule of Parliament that has been prejudiced or shortcut in the process of bringing this bill to Parliament. So those cases cannot be applicable. And furthermore, even if they were correct in their analysis that there is a fault on the part of the minister, then it cannot affect Parliament in their process, because the minister is not taking a decision, so the Administrative Justice Act should not be applicable to her. And secondly, the Parliament, as the lawmakers and exercising the lawmaking function as such, is not subjected to the Administrative Justice Act. It is not the Administrative Justice, it's the lawmaking function. So here, based on all those issues, it is our opinion, and as the DG already indicated, we've got quite a wide range of legal experts advising us on this issue,
and we are very confident that this is not unconstitutional.
And that,
Compact for Clause 1, submission by this department. Given the state of our education, I really want to see the forum or the council being a ground where other battles are being fought. We would like to see the council or the department being tied, not making decisive decisions, quick effective. So therefore, for those reasons, I'm satisfied with the establishment on taking place.
I propose to move on, you know, in the light of these convincing explanations by the department.
Let's allow that. I know where you stand.
Yes. Let me just finish up. Backed by standing legislation, when we look at that amendment, we have got to look at it against the background of that principal text that it was amended. If you look now at the original text of the National Education Policy Act, as you are indicated, I'm reading verbatim. Consultation on legislation. Legislation on the matter referred to in Section 3, meaning an enactment of law, policy legislation, shall be introduced in Parliament. Or, in the case of regulation, the publishing in the Gazette only after consultation between the Minister and Council. And Council, in this case, as defined by this Act, does not refer to this NETC. It refers to the Council of Ministers of Education. And, again, concurrently, the Minister may consult. The emphasis is on May, even on the principal act. Now, May gives the minister liberty to do or not to do so. And it has been explained while this body existed in law, it was not functional because it would have been too big. And also the mechanisms of getting it moving forward, consultation with getting mandates and so on. What this clause amends is to find a situation where the minister, if she so desires, can create an appropriate consultative body with a focus not on constituencies to get money, with a focus of creating an effective educational system. I think
I don't believe I'm not about time.
Yes,
because I don't want to repeat the same thing.
Yes. We have got to take on board is that when there are public hearings, people are here to protect their health because they've got mandate to do. But we must also distinguish between utterances that do not have legal basis and this is the case
we We must object to what his member said. You explain the purpose for the ministry in an informal stage where parties express the open. We're not really in a compose not to understand what he's saying. He's implying that we, the rest, are in a compose who are not understanding this in memory objection.
I'm not
there.
Thank you.
But
the ACDT is not convinced. So the technical explanation by the legal advisor is valid and he understands it completely. But to me, and quite possibly to many others, it sounds like a lot of semantics around government and ministers' policy and the legislation. And it's possibly unlikely to impress the court to have themselves shown a kind of leaning towards the broadest interpretation to accommodate the kind of participation of stakeholders that they would see as relevant in our kind of democracy, and I've got the DFL case in mind. And they may find that it's not unreasonable to have expected the minister, in terms of legislation, to have established the NECC and to have taken advice. And so we actually could be taking a big leap on the budget of Parliament's legal department in terms of just assuming that they won't read into this kind of argument. I could say seated where I'm seated and getting a sense and a feel of what I'm getting a sense and a feel of, you're kind of saying, because of the majority of people here, there's a minister who put pressure on to do this. We don't have to worry about the minister complying because Parliament can just push it through and then it can be legal because Parliament's pushed it through. So I apologize, but that's the sense and a feel of what I'm getting from that little argument. And to say that we need to ignore hearings because people who come are putting certain agendas forward is absolutely horrendous. Because every single person who takes the time and the trouble to come and present at a hearing are representing members of our constituencies and South Africa broadly, and we have to take those things seriously. And where there was a majority of various and different understandings of people who were very concerned around this issue. Okay.
Yes, that's what happened on last Friday. I don't think we're not taking the city out to see that.
Was
that
right?
Yes. No, we're taking over the
point. I've never had any intention of saying that, you know, the people who come here, you know, we should not take them seriously. But nobody can deny that, in a sense, they are representing their constituencies and their content.
Can I take it therefore, for now we have covered clause 1 and 3. So can we go to clause 2? They were not voting today, we're not debating. We have to get an understanding. What does this clause mean to all of us? Is there any comment on clause 2? Is there any proposed amendment on clause 2? That takes us, therefore, to clause 4. We open our clause 4 for debate. Naptosa agreed to that one. Fed Plus, well, some of us, that includes Paragraph Israel. And Fed Plus, down there, we're talking about quite about Lika and other things. And just to alert again, maybe just thinking about that. If you go to, I'm referring to the pair of scissors and beacons and what have you. If you go to AA, if you go to page 7, page 4. Remember in that clause 4, we are talking about the industry of that. We are talking about the illegal drugs and what have you, and the concern there was liquor is not mentioned there. And what about the pair of scissors? If you go to page 4, clause 7, 8A1. It says, unless authorized by the principal for the estimated statement paper, no person may bring the dangerous object or legal drug on the school premises or a such object or drug in use, which means one can assume that when you talk about physical instruments and what have you, those are the things that the principal has said are things that should be brought on. Though they seem to be dangerous, they are part of. As far as NECA is concerned, I think we do understand that each school has a code of conduct. And that code of conduct includes some of this. And this law does not kick out those. It is an over-the-bar thing. While you are having your code of conduct, having all those things not to do, NECA, you name it. We are also saying these are some of the additional weapons. Because of the weapons, tools that we are giving. I'm just trying to clarify that clause 4. But largely, any comment on that? Let's hope that there's no debate on clause 4. That takes us to clause 5, the normal standard. This was supported by Nostosa, Coase, etc. And Sao didn't oppose it, just said it is vague. It has to do with the norms of balance.
Chairperson, from the side of the ANC, we're broadly in agreement with five, but there are one or two grammatical or semantic changes that we would like to propose just for the better reading of the poll. And then there's one commission, so there's about the three little amendments that we want to suggest. Can I go ahead and make those?
Yeah.
Okay, the one is at the bottom of the page, that is page 3 in line 52. That's 2A. In respect of the school infrastructure, I think it should read, in respect of school infrastructure, if we could remove the to omit the V. So we're proposing that it should read, in respect of school infrastructure. And then it says there, the availability of, and then follows a number of things, starting with one classroom, going down to five at the bottom of the page. If we go over the page to page 4, 6, right at the top of page 4, it talks about laboratories for science, technology, mathematics, and biology. Now, biology is now called in the curriculum life science. So we just proposing that in terms of that biology changes to life science on the top of page 4. 7 is recreational activities. 8 is a 8. And then we would like to propose a 9 thereafter 8, something that in our opinion has been omitted, and that is the 9 perimeter security. 9 perimeter security, that is line 4, page 4. It's a new 9, in fact, perimeter security. And then if we go further down, a chair to C4, that is line 15, there's another biology there, and to replace that biology also with life science, because that's what it's being, so that's how it is being referred to now. So those are the sort of grammatical changes that we're proposing, and the addition of perimeter security, which is a new 9 under A. Thank you, Chair.
Remember that?
On that line 52, say I'm unclear. Let's acknowledge my limitations. As far as the English is concerned.
Line 52?
The removal of that pay doesn't change the meaning of the sentence. If it doesn't, have no problem. But if it does...
It is a very referring to a de-aesthetic school. When you say school infrastructure, it's not enough. Once you put that D, it's as though you are talking about a aesthetic school.
I thought that was the meaning, that if we are referring to a
particular school, you have this school.
I have a school in South Africa, general. All schools must have them. That is unfair. In a way, doesn't make much difference. Can it move then away from course 5? And I think there's no more engagement on course 5. We go to clause 6. We are supported by CESTA, supported by NAPROSA, supported by. Any comments on that? That means that code of conduct is some support for not to violate that. That takes us to clause 7. The random tests and FISA and drug testing and so on.
Yeah, Chair, with regard to 7, there are a few changes that we are obviously flagging now and then would propose formally at the formal stage. At the hearings, there was quite some discussion raised about the word random, this random search and seizure. So the word random came under quite a bit of scrutiny, and I think that we need a further explanation of random. So we are proposing from the side of the ANC that we have a new subsection 1, that is in line 39, that we have a new subsection 1, and the wording that we propose for that subsection 1 is as follows, and I read it into the record. For the purpose of this section, random means the identification of any group of learners who are reasonably suspected of an illegal conduct relating to dangerous objects or illegal drugs. That is the new subsection 1 that we are proposing in terms of the meaning of random. There are some others further in that clause. Should I go on, or do you want me to pause?
Maybe that is our layman's definition of random. We are open for more debate and discussion on that, and I think we are going to, if our legal colleagues can clear that. This is our layman's definition. Whether that fits the deal in reference as it relates to what the people were saying. When you say random, is it a random in time, is it a random group, is it a random, that's what we're trying to explain. So that is, as I say, our layman's approach to that. We leave this to our legal colleagues. If they feel that we're going overboard or there's another way, we are open for that. And of that.
And it's a reasonable suspicion. Was also brought up, and the suggestion was that we change to reasonable grounds. I would like to look at that.
We tried this, and we put it out again, our layman's perspective on that. And once we say reasonable grounds, we are bringing it to the police technical legal, which our teachers do not have. It was a cautious term that was used. Once we say reasonable grounds, it comes with those legal technicalities where your agency, they are going to tell you no issues are saying this is blah blah. So we are preferring to leave it as it is.
First on the random definition. Well, I appreciate your statement that you leave that even to different parties
may
go
because there may be other definitions.
Yeah.
I appreciate that one. Then on that one, there was a suggestion that that's fair. There was a question, what type of suspicion is fair? There was a suggestion that leave reasonable, but remove this fair suspicion. What is a fair suspicion?
Why does that happen? Just allow a legal police to say what is a fair.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the Roman Dutch law, the concept of a reasonable man, reasonable as a criteria, has been fairly deeply entrenched in our legislation and in our law. But you would find that the principle or the criteria of fairness has been introduced by the labor law and also in the constitution with unfair discrimination, especially when it comes to issues where it links up with possible victimization, abuses, and processes around that. And therefore, the purists would go for reasonableness as the only criteria. But when you deal with discriminatory practices, abuses, that type of issue, the concept of fairness became a valid criteria, because it goes beyond reasonableness, and also it can be reasonable to make a specific action because there's reason to it, but it might not be fair under the circumstances. And because of the complexity of this particular exercise, it is very important that it's not only reasonable, but it should also be fair when you deal with the procedures and make sure that the fairness also plays an important role when it comes to the execution
thereof. That does sound sound to me.
Yeah. Well, any questions that come to my mind is, are principals prepared to make those kind of judgments? I mean, is there something that's going to specify or train them to be absolutely certain how the courts are going to be fair and reasonable? And because again, it sounds like it's going to get terribly complicated.
I thought that's why you are keeping this outside the court in the beginning. Remember when you have done all these things, there is a clause somewhere, well, at the back, where we say the school cannot take criminals. If I want to take criminals, the first place that will ask in court is you read his right. So we're leaving this in that atmosphere where it's more of a, these people are not used. That's why you are trying to put it in such a way that you don't go overboard in the legalistic.
So just to get me to see the right context here. So who would then be judging that it's fair and reasonable? You know, in what situation? You know, we're obviously looking at this clause now.
Yeah.
Who would judge that it wasn't fair or reasonable, or that it was fair or reasonable?
Let me take it across to the footage.
The disciplinary committee of your school governing body.
I think we need to constantly understand we are trying to bring these things to the school environment. And again, as we do that, in no way in this deal is any principal forced to do anything. Remember, this is an enabling. It's something that says, if you are this given principal in this given situation, you feel you should say to something. You must know there is some law to rely on. So even doing these things, if you read it, it is the principal which would go to decide to win or don't win. Do we move on? Do you want to add?
Sir, I think the DD is 100% correct. The final analysis will rest with the committee in terms of the code of conduct and which is linked to due and fair procedures. But it is also true that when it comes to the actual decision on the spot, the principal or his or a delegatee must also exercise the discretion at that point in time. And reasonableness is just a matter of there must be a reason behind it. And that is, any administrator in any school is bound by that principle on a daily basis. You must have a reason in terms of the administrator. Justice act for any action you take. And this is the same principle. If you've got a reason, you comply. There's no special concept. And when it comes to fairness, it's once again the same principle that you deal with constitutional rights and fair discrimination. It is a valid judgment on a set of facts based on a criteria of fairness. And you don't need specific and specialized training to do that. So here, this is, if the executor of that decision falters, then obviously it won't have a prejudice to the learner because the process will be the safeguard that somebody will then say, sorry, there's a mistake, and they will rectify it in future.
Just to add to that, every day when we drive our car, all of us are subjected to the reasonable person standard in terms of how we drive our car and whether that will be decisive on the question whether we were negligent or not when we made an accident. So that yardstick applies to everyone on a daily basis.
I then proceed with the next point in
Can I ask one more thing?
Yeah, okay.
Obviously just on our recent trip we discovered that principles are very specifically trained for their jobs and such more so than we are here. And I'm just wondering whether it wouldn't be wise in this kind of situation for the department to have considered some sort of specific training that a principal should go on to enable them to deal with these sort of issues. It doesn't seem unreasonable to me, and maybe it would have to come about directly to them, before the school's really able to deal with this, the principal should have completed this certain training.
Unfortunately, that was the first time we're in the process of training there. For a long time, we're just throwing into the air. David, do you want to comment on that?
Well, no, I think we defy the notion that not just principals, but any others who would be involved here, there needs to be training. But I think as the legal advisor says, no one should have to be trained to be fair and reasonable. So that's the first thing.
That's sort of just simplifying it a bit. Recognizing drugs, knowing when to bring steps in, when not to. But, I mean, there's a lot there that is out of the general purview of the principal domain, maybe not today.
Yes. Yeah. The state advisor wants to say something.
Thank you. And just there, if the committee is really, if it is the committee, I would just like to raise the content in the country with the commission. Not comfortable in a way to indicate that with regard to the identification of any group of learners, in a way, if we say it is random now, can sort of open a door with for victimization, which is in a sense the bill that it is not it does not intend to do. My question is that we should leave this is defining random, and this is also sort of identified as a problem even in the general country. Random and our city is that the criminal prosecution does not define random. So I would be sort of suggest that we leave random without defining and leave the city a true that is we can sort of think this is over.
My wife don't think, let us not decide on that now. That's why I deliberately said we need to sleep on it. It creates a room for you and others to sit and come up and advise us. Remember, we have this 4-month conversation on Friday, where we'll be. now I'm sorry you have consulted and debated and discussed and come. As of now, let us leave it hanging. The door has been opened. So I don't want us to engage and say, do we or don't we?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, before reading the next proposal, I just want to say one of the things that was picked up in terms of this random search of the school is the question of the parent having to be informed. We thought that was something that we thought was missing though one recognizes that the search is random, the question of informing the parent as soon as possible, and we are therefore proposing that on page 5, after line 4, we have B there, and then after line 4 that we insert a C, that is before number 4, that we insert C, which says the following: the principal must within one day inform the parent that a random search and seizure was done in respect of his or her child. So that is what we are proposing there. Shall I go on with the others or shall I pause?
Yes, maybe let's try to command that one second. See if there are any comments. I have that.
In one of the proposals, the recommendation was that we put that reasonable measures have been taken to ensure that notice to search the learner has been given to the parents and guardians of the said learner. Could you maybe just comment that on how that would affect?
Can you repeat that?
It said that to put it in a clause saying that reasonable measures have been taken to ensure that notice to search the learner has been given to the parents or guardians of the said learner.
But if you give notice, somebody has not said, because if you give a notice that I'm going to send you tomorrow, you will just be trolley. By the time you said there's a notice.
Then it's not
I'm saying that's why this is sensitive, because you know they are carrying, and you know this guy, you keep having to wait this one. So I think that amendment is saying, once you have done that, it behoves the school to formally inform the parents that we give special things. This is an aside, not before. That was the proposal.
But what you are suggesting about informing the parents, I think it's there and
that was something else. If you go down to line 49, that's a different. I'm saying this new clause, it accommodates clause in line 49. If you go down to that line 49, there's another statement. You see line 49? Inform the parents that a random test.
Yes.
You have that in that leads to that urine test. And the first one is on a different place.
Yes, sorry again.
Yes.
You know, the sense that I was getting at the hearing was the idea of just randomly testing anywhere, as opposed to the idea of being enabled to test where you had some sense that there was a group, you couldn't tell who, but there was some reason to want to be testing within that group, and not just randomly testing anybody in the whole school. And I'm just trying to get a sense of if we've really thought through if we need to go to the if the random is going to be relevant, but and if we should narrow it down to where it's thought that there's a reasonable suspicion, and then there can be that random testing within that.
Are you saying, as it says, it doesn't cover that? So what you're saying here, it is allowing the principal EPS, there is an ample substitution, but that heat in fast freeze is turning black. Therefore, she just goes to grade 5 in order to set everybody in that by knowing that he's coming in 8. And we're saying when you are doing that, it is random in that case, in the sense that the yeast is in grade 7 and we're setting grade 7. Or we know this step can fix this when he's going to sport. He is part of natural yeast. So we go to that one. It becomes random in that one. And what we're saying now, we're not sure how to define that. And that's why we left the door open, whether it's that little. And we're saying, therefore, the first one was talking about those genderless waveforms and these are different black matter. And it is ending up saying, once you have set for those, the new line that is put in around that, is saying, once you have set for those black and what you have used, you inform that. And the next one talks about urine test, which is not that black and what is. Once you have done this urine test, you are on line 49. You must inform the customer.
The random test or test
is it? Maybe. Maybe can look at that. Yes.
That's what I said. The super or the key or her to the mind. Hey, we see one day, inform the parent that a random test or test. And freedom for
a child in the
spirit of
food
or her child.
Yes,
yesterday,
some of the
people. Can we
clean
that
up?
Yeah.
Yeah, can I just respond to that, Chair? Because I'm reading them one by one and I haven't got to that section yet. We are actually proposing that we delete that and that this one that I've just in the position of C. As I've indicated, 3C, the depth he places A down there, there's in fact something else that we are proposing for that.
I agree with that, Brother. Instead of repeating, if you go down to this document, it keeps going down when he talks about line 49. He says that line that talks about the parents and whatever, leave it out. So it is covered in the new. You take it out at 49, you put it in up there, which means once you have said or tested, do inform the parent. I'm comfortable. I'm trying to check you off because we don't want to be redundant. Yes, it would be redundant if we put it there and see. And then the CD is in 949. So that new C is all invasive in the sense that when there is a test or a test, you must inform the test.
But there's a difference in the CD.
Yes.
In A, it says, but inform the parents that they learn of test. In B, it says, but inform the parents of the results. We suggest that there is an interval between the test and analyzing the results, probably by the expert for that.
Well, where is the result?
What is the result?
Keep on everything. This line.
That is 51, Chair. It's 51.
So I talk about the result. See if he talks about the expert test.
How is the I'm not talking about 51 letters. I'm not talking about 51, I'm talking about 50. I think both of us are talking about 50.
Yeah.
That the other one must be removed because otherwise it's redundant.
Yes,
which I agree with you.
Because if you go to 10A, it says the principal is her delegated mass. Within one day, inform his parents that a random test of sex and pizza was done in the spec of. This is one that was saying, take that away.
Yeah, correct.
Once you take that away, you have the new one that is coming up there, up before, up above 4. And that covered everything.
Yeah, it does.
and there's no litigation.
Not just one.
Are we here with that?
Yeah, just again, but very helpful. Yes. I just want to be sure that we understand. Are we saying that it's entirely unreasonable to, if we are about to search a certain small group of kids, because we think that there's something going on there, is it entirely unreasonable to expect some sort of reasonable attempt at notifying parents that we are going to, not the day before, not the night before, not in time to ward kids, whatever, but the kids are there, school, this is going to go up, down. If those parents had wanted to be there while this was going on, is it unreasonable?
Yeah, because I'm saying, this is something that is so random, actually, nobody can know which I'm really doing. Because if you have a time perspective, to phone the parent, to phone what they do, especially with SMS and things. Once you phone anybody, give it only 3 minutes, say, I'm going to pounce on that class. The SMS is going to come flying.
Just maybe to clarify that, as you explained, this is enabling legislation. No school is forced to do this. And I think that's what is understood, and certainly the fact at the moment, any school that intends doing random drug testing tends to consult the school governing body at the beginning of the year and says, are we going to do this or not? I think that's probably the buy-in you need. Once that's been decided, then I don't think an individual parent can come and say, no, not my child. So perhaps that's just what we need to understand about consulting the parents on a very general basis. Chetra, can I just clarify the wording then? The proposed clause does not refer to testing that has been raised. That the informed parents that a search and seizure has been done. Is that
No, we corrected that. I said honor to us what is B. Why not at Gen D? We're not interfering with Gen D. We're interfering with Gen A. I think we're all here with that. Honorable, do you have anything?
Chair, the next one is on page 5, line 13, where we are talking of one witness of the same gender as the learner being present. We had quite a bit of discussion around that witness, because that witness could, in fact, the way it stands, be a child as well. So we think it's very important that witness be an adult witness. So we would like to change that wording in 9:30 to one adult witness. And then there is another one witness referred to. The same argument holds, that is in 9:43. That is 9C, which refers to one witness again of the same gender as the learner, and we're saying there in 43 as well, it should be one adult witness. So in both those cases, we are saying one adult witness.
Any comments on that? Go on, Nathaniel.
Okay. I'm now on line 43 C, where I in fact ended now, which is one adult learner of the same gender as the learner is present. Now that little section, but not in the view of the learner, gave rise to a lot of debate and complication. So we are proposing that we delete that portion, but not in view of the learner, because that just creates confusion. So that C then, the full C then reads, one adult witness of the same gender as the learner is present. And we can leave that step, but not in the view of the
learner. I'm not going to, are we together?
Okay, I'm listening very carefully. I'm trying to
Yes, because this is a new member in this committee. So are we happy with that? We are happy with that. Yes. Anything new on the committee?
Yes, then we're going to line 49, the same page. That A, as we've already said, is omitted now. That the A as a stood, because we've done a new, so we omit that A, we scratch it out, but then we substitute it, now we're dealing with the question of the urine test. And we are saying the new A should say, inform parents before the urine test is done. Inform parents before the urine test is done, if practicable, in respect of his or her child, and then hopefully follow. I'll repeat that. A new A, line 49, inform parents before the urine test is done, if practicable, in respect of his or her child.
Technical. Yeah. You can see there, if we start in sub 9, you all other non-invasive that the rest of sub 9 talks about the test. Only the test, because it refers to both those tests. So I was just wondering, maybe we should just drop the word urine in this proposal before test, so that it informs parents for the test itself. Because it can refer in terms of sub 9 to two possible tests.
I would hate to do that. This test, like we have a test, could have no information. We just take off the urine part of it. We hate to do that. I don't really have to understand this proposal. That we just take off the urine.
Take off the urine
Parent
before the test.
Yes.
And by implication, we're referring to urine.
Oh, non-invasive. But once you put on urine, which is now a study.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. No, no, I see.
Come
just as a matter of interest, I see you qualify to say it's practicable. It's not practical, so that you could go on. But just a question of how long do you wait to reach the parent before you test this urine, which is also random testing.
That probably cannot change your commodity. If it is next door, you can run. If not, you can base it on that policy, which was agreed to in the SGD. That in this school, we have, among others, we are going to be testing our. Therefore, when you are implementing it, where the children, everybody does know. In this school, it is a drug-free, blah, 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 in order to maintain that time and again, we are going to have these random tests. But if whatever reason, the parent is driving some friends around to run to college, if not, you don't say, I'm not going to do it because this kid here is from the Eastern Cape. So a lot of these kids that are here, they come far away sometimes. And the guardian is some aunt in some place who cannot go, who even fears to go to that school. Therefore, if you have made a such program, don't talk quiet.
Can the parents refuse?
No. Okay, I'm saying if it is in the quality. If you have agreed at this school, that this is a gun-free, this is a drug-free, in order to maintain that data, these are the tools. Therefore, parents understand this is one of those things. If you don't want to abide by that, you must as well take your kid away.
See, then they call it something cool. Do we cross over to verse 8? Again, we remember, just a late member, that remember there were some controversies around clause 14, sub clause 14 and 15. No criminal prosecution is needed. Our understanding, that is deliberately so, because it didn't follow this legalistic thing. If you are going to make it a criminal, first of all, you must read the right of this before you do, and the school cannot do that. Because the school are not expecting to do that, out of what they are doing, this is an internal count of amare. It cannot be translated into criminal. I'm just raising that so that we have an understanding of why that clause is there. One of that, you dying, open the can of worms.
Yeah. The sense that I was getting off from the hearing was that this could make schools a safe haven for drug activity. So, you know, obviously I haven't had a lot of time to interrogate this thought, but the idea that it's going to be a lot safer for all of the drug activity to be done at school, because you're going to get this minor little kind of disciplinary stuff going on in the court, and you're safe from the court. So that was worrying for me.
Actually, that would worry if we're assuming that it is preventing the norm. If you take this as if this school cannot meet it, do nothing, no sense, inform the police. This is not preventing.
So they could do that.
They could do that. So, under no circumstances we bring up this to say now we are preventing the normal way of thinking. If you have this drug and what have you, you feel, I'm afraid I can't do it, just call the body. But if you follow this book, know that you will not be in a position to follow individualistic police way, and don't prepare that one. Did we move to clause 8?
Well,
clause 8 now. The functions of the principle. Do you want to come first with an amendment to come and come or do we have a question of God to be another group for them that is eating to say what they are saying with their part? They don't even know this part of the...
Well, as a Democrat, I would allow the majority party.
Yeah, Chair, it's just a very small one. It's not a... major one, but an important one nevertheless. A line 25. It's there where we are talking about the academic, to the academic performance improvement plan, plus B, and then AA says presented to the head of department. After head of department, we just want to insert it. On a date determined by him or her. After head of department, on a date determined by him or her. Just for the good order of things. So let's put that in. And that's basically the only change that we are proposing to make. But some of my other colleagues will speak on that.
Maybe I'm suggesting we do what we did with the first clause. The now department to speak, since there is a kind of a misunderstanding of the role of the principal in that school council. I think maybe let's use it, the same thing that we did in the first floor, that allows the department just to clarify what is it? What is it? What is the basis? And what are we basing it? How can you say somebody who is a member of the SCP to end up saying all these things that were saying?
Especially that last section.
Yeah.
So thank you, Chair. If I can just try to recap the position of the of the that was put in a public hearing, it boils down to the fact that a principal is a member of the governing body and that such in a position of trust as is provided for in Section 16(2) of the South African school. A member that is in a governing body who is in that position of trust must therefore come in and participate without any prejudice or any links to other entities which might affect the working of the governing body, because there's a single criterion: they must always work in the best interest of the school. They've also said that if you leave the provisions as it is, it would be unconstitutional on the basis that that individual would be restricted in its right to freedom of association and freedom of speech, in that they cannot express themselves freely as a citizen of the
That's why I let the members on that clause 8, why in particular now looking at that subsection 3. Remember the controversial subsection 3?
Yes.
It deals with A, C, and 4. I'm deliberately asking the department just to take us through so that there's some understanding.
The argument then concluded by saying that it would be unconstitutional, further, even if it is put as a limitation in an act of parliament, because it would not be in alliance with the test as is provided by Section 36 of the Constitution. Here, once again, one must unpack these issues. I think it is very important that when you look at the principal, you must acknowledge that the principal is a manager appointed in a school by the state. And as a manager in any organization, there is also a position of trust. In fact, it is such an important position of trust that in any business, a manager which is in breach of this position of trust will be fired immediately if there is a breach of this relationship. So here it is two aspects of trust that one must deal with here. The principal is also, in terms of Section 16(3), which is the very next section to the one that was referred to by the stakeholders, provides that in Section 16(3), it provides that the principal performs the functions of the professional management under the authority of the head of the department. That means, by law, the principal is the delegated authority to deal with all the issues which is under the authority of the head of the department and which must be performed by the head of the department in that specific school. So it is not an innocent person standing there, but a person who actually performed the function on behalf of the head of the board. So it's not only a position of trust, but that person who must actively involve him or herself in the day-to-day running of the school on behalf of, or the word used, under the authority of the head of the board. So here, if you look at that, and then come to the two fundamental rights that's been...
Okay, can you read that to us? Do you say is it 16 or 16?
16, 16. 1-6.
In SASA, 16.
In SASA, 1-6.
16 sub 3.
What does it mean?
Yeah, I can read it to you. I've got it here with me. Okay, it reads, subject to this act and any applicable provincial law, the professional management of a public school must be undertaken by the principal under the authority of the head of the department. So here, this is a must provision, it's not even a discretion, and it is it's the eyes and ears of and hands of the department. So, head who can't be in every school, and this head of the department is not only represented but is given the function of the head of the department, which is necessary to perform in that school, to the principal. And therefore it is a very important position. As I said, it's a position of trust, but it goes beyond that position of trust by becoming actually involved in the action. As I said, they link it to two fundamental rights. The one of freedom of association and freedom of speech. So if you look at freedom of association, it is a well-known principle that if I apply for a job and I get that job, I subject myself to the conditions of service and the framework applicable to that job. Here, my freedom of association is elected at that point in time when I elected to go and do that job. Once I'm in that job, I am within the framework, and the employer can tell me to go and operate in specific structures. They can tell me, no, you don't speak to the media, because it's not your responsibility. They can tell me not to go to specific meetings or organizations within my working hours, because it is not related to my work. And my freedom of association will therefore, if it is, have a direct impact on the work relationship, will be restricted. Actually, if we look at the principle here, it is his involvement in the governing body is directly related to his conditions of employment. It is not a sporting activity or a recreation activity or a church activity, which is outside the job relationship. This is directly involving the job description. So there is no problem when the employer tells the principal, you in the committee, that your role in that committee must be a specific role. Now, because the delegation was done through legislation and not through the normal process of the employer giving the instruction to the employee, it was done through a statutory delegation. And the reason for that is 29,000 schools. It would be impossible for a principal in 1997 to have delegations to all the schools in time to deal with it. And that's why the legislature in their wisdom decided to make it a statutory delegation. But yeah, that delegation is now also the reason for this section, for this clause, in order to bring clarification and clarity to what is this role. Because you've got two positions of trust. You are the principals are totally confused as to what they must do and how they must deal with it. But here, before I'm getting to that one, I just want to deal with the other fundamental right, and that is the right to express yourself freely. If I'm in a job and it is related to work, then the employer has got a right to tell me what information I can make available and what participation I can have when it comes to to sharing information and be active in a specific structure. So here, if it comes to dealing with the job relationship, your labor relations, and your employment issues, it is also a constitutional principle which was not put in perspective by the various role players who made presentations at that meeting. They stopped short of introducing these very important concepts. Yeah. And now let's move to those two paragraphs in the bill dealing with the giving evidence. Yeah. If it was under normal circumstances where the principals were not confused about the fact and about the role to be played in the two structures, the one as the employment relationship and the other one within the governing body, then a provision of this would not be necessary. But it is, there's no doubt, there's a huge confusion as to what is the role of a principal within a governing body structure. The president has made the position that all the members are treated equal and everyone must play a specific role. But yet they also, by implication, say that the principal is the crucial role player. And in fact, they even use the analogy of a board of directors. Yeah, a board of directors, which is a concept which is used in companies and which is definitely differentiable from the schools act and the school setup. It is the issue or the conflicting issues of who's the employer and the different employers is not coming into play because they are outside and it is appointment within a specific statutory structure. The aspect of the role of the chief executive officer in such structure is actually to execute functions which are made by it. And the only authority who can make decisions is that board of directors. In the school, it's not the case. We've got a partnership here. A partnership where the department represented by the principal is the one partner and they must perform a specific function. And the board of directors or the governing body are only dealing with governance issues. And they, if they take a decision on governance, the principal can perform the CEO function and execute those functions. And they're not going to take the minister or the deputy minister or the MEC or the head of department to court if the principal is not performing his or functions properly in executing their decision. They are taking the minister and the MEC and the head of department to court because of the two roles, the function that is exercised by the head of department as an active authority. That is the position they take to, or that is the action which is addressed and which is taken to court. So the analogy they use, I think it's totally inappropriate, because it is not, it's not comparing apples with apples. Yeah. The last thing which is very important is that when you deal with the functions of a school, you've got the two sentences following one another, the one on governance, the one on management. Governance being amplified by the functions of the governing body. The one on professional management is a total silence in the piece of legislation as to what is the essence, how do you understand what is the professional management. With this amendment, it is now bringing that balance. It's addressing
the issue which is causing the confusion in the mind of the principal. And therefore, it will avoid a lot of the challenges education had in court in the past. And so let's look at the challenges. There's three categories. The one is the appointment of educators. Yeah, that's actually an issue which is going on in the classroom. It's a professional management issue, if you want to categorize it. If the governing body got an interest and got a recommendation function, but it is not a decision-making function at all. When it comes to the next category, it is the issue of admitting learners to the school. There's section 5 of the Schools Act very clear. That is the responsibility of the head of the department. It's not the responsibility of the governing body. And here lastly, it is the category of admitting learners within a specific language of instruction stream, different languages of instruction in a school, parallel medium, dual medium. Once again, it's going on in a classroom. It is directly relating to the activities within the delivery of the educational program. The court has a problem because they didn't know how to deal with it, because there was not enough guidance in the Act. The principals have a problem because they don't know how to deal with it, and this is an attempt to deal with that. There is no attempt in this legislation to muddle the principal, because all this the bill contains is to say, principal, you are the representative of the employer, and as the representative on any action which is taken against the head of the department, which is the employer, which is containing to a authority exercised by that person, which you as the principal by law is responsible to perform in the school, that you must be the first witness for that authority and cannot be sided with the governing body for whatever reason. And here, if you really look at it, you should never get a principal to go and become a witness in a case against the school. But that is not a reality on the ground. And because it is not a reality on the ground, there is a need to put such a provision in there. If it was in a perfect world, this would not have been the case. But because of the confusion, because of a whole array of factors, it becomes a necessary provision to be included in order to avoid a confusion. And so lastly, if the principal is not used by the head of the department because of any reason to cause an injustice or not, the truth being put to the court in order to come to a fair and just decision, the court will have the responsibility to call that witness, and it is specifically, unless the court allows it, the principal will then be called in. So if the head of department is decided for whatever reason not to call the principal, the court will still get an application from the governing body to say, please call him as a witness, and that evidence will be there. So there is no prejudice to the legal system or the legal process of whatsoever. Thank you, sir.
Mullin partner gave an example there. I don't know if I've forgotten what that school was, but Mullin and Tambor.
Yeah, it's a little primary school.
If I can
just also address that one. He was referring to a situation where a child been found guilty on misconduct, and where the school made a recommendation for expulsion. It was accepted by the head of department, and the kid has been expelled. But the head of department then raised his or her fears and not execute the decision, and in the end, the kid still there and continue with illegal activities or misconduct activities. Here, once again, one must look at what is the issue here. It is not the principal who will be the leading or the crucial party or a witness in dealing with a dispute of this nature. Discipline belongs to the disciplinary or to the governing body through a disciplinary provision. In all the provinces, the position and the governing body is also accepted this, that the principal leads the evidence and a disciplinary committee consisting of parents is then deciding the outcome of the disciplinary hearing. So it is that decision which is referred, and if there is a dispute on the implementation of it, then it would be through the governing body chairperson who will lead the dispute in order to ensure that a court give a mandamus to the head of department to perform his or her responsibility as is provided for in law. And it's not a principle. And the governing body is not prejudiced by the fact that the principle is not leading that whole process. The governing or the disciplinary hearing committee chairperson or the governing body chairperson is the more appropriate one who will be in a position to give evidence and assist the court in getting the dog.
A pause for comment.
I'm going to the punishing is by the department, which is in their many respects clarifies the issue. But having said that, one of the most important features of Indian education that must be in a simple language to be understood by a common person like myself down there in Wapu. But as it stands, as it goes, natural. As it stands, from our side, we feel it's a bit, to put in a simple language, first of the explanation that I have given, we need an elaborate explanation to understand the intention behind what is down there. As it stands, therefore, we find it hard to accept it, you know, that one. Because I tell you, I rush in this morning with some legal advisors and phones and other legal advisors. He could be, in fact, I must admit here, perhaps he gave his opinion on his insufficient information for my partner must allow for that one. But he also said, no, that is unconstitutional. Reading it as it is, bad. He said, no, this is unconstitutional. It's a very important legal person whom we follow. So I'm saying, as it stands, really, it's not as simple as he has explained it. So we find it an accessory step here.
Thank you,
we could ask, is obliged to promote and protect the best interests of the school, which may include testifying against whoever wishes to bring the school into disrepute or may cause damage to the school. That is what some of the protect preventers yesterday said in terms of the function of the principal on the school governing body. So how do you explain that kind of context? And the way that it seems to be read just generally, as my colleague is saying at the top here, is that headmasters, principals are being muggled because they're not able to testify to the truth of a matter. And because they hold this kind of position on the school governing body, and they, you know, so there is definitely a sense that when we read this legislation, that principals may be then fulfilling what you see to be their legislative mandate on the one side, but it just seems that they're doing it to the complete detriment of their mandate on the other side. So we need to be able to see that balance more clearly and to be able to explain that more simply.
Yes, I'm getting disturbed to see why we're understanding where you're coming from, especially after that 15-3, to say who is this person. But as it stands, yes. Can we testify? Yes.
Thank you, Chair. With regard to one looks at the way that provision is crafted, would notice that if I sort of may pick up from the speakers, that is even from the public hearing, there is a sense of misunderstanding or the misinterpretation of this provision, in the sense that there is a sense that as I pick up that they sort of think that it sort of violate section 35 of the Constitution, whereby a person is supposed to be prevented to go to court and give evidence. This is not the case here. If you read that, the principal may not, on behalf of the governing body. So it is clear that the principal, as an ad officio to the governing body, he is representing the head of department and the embassy or the minister. So is there the mouth of the head of department? So he cannot now turn and give evidence when in natural practice he is the head of department. So it is not like saying that the principal cannot may not go to court and give evidence. That is in his personal capacity. But there is that qualification on behalf of the government body. I think that must be understood in that sense.
No, one point, is that simply enough?
The fact that the clause is generating this discussion means that it's either back in process that we don't understand it, or it is first of all unconstitutional. But we welcome the explanation. I was now as part of the rest to go back again, discuss it, and come back on Friday with the final position. We welcome those these further explanations.
From where I'm sitting, after this explanation, and he's going to say, if for example, a school kid in a given school dies and come and tap into them, that is not the deity of the school, it is the deity of the school. Which means the problems are not there, but it is their deity. This principle in the FGP, his eyes and ears representing whatever happens in the school system, in the SDP, comes through him. If there is something that the SDP has against it, the MEC, it should be something that came through his mouth and that. Therefore, the MEC in a school is a principal. The head of the person in a school is a principal. Because according to that 16.3, that That is who he is. If the FDD has anything against the MEC, in actual fact, means he has everything against the principal. Therefore, the principal cannot, who is the conduit? The MEC, the head of department, all those things are not there. Therefore, if the FDD is against the MEC, the first animal, it is the principal. Therefore, the principal cannot turn and say, against himself, because once he becomes a witness against the MEC, this time it means he is a witness against himself. That's how I'm reading. So, but if there is something against the principal, and the principal is a person, he can take the MEC, anybody, to court, but not in his, because of the constitution in the FDD.
Just one small question for further clarification. Take a scenario, say in the olden days, where the state is really, has gone really bad, you know, the state. Okay? And the principal is supposed to be representing that state. Still, that principal is tied not to to say anything against that state. I'm thinking of the scenario, the olden days, you know, when the apartheid state, the principal, represented the department. The teachers, unionized teachers, would say, hey, this is rubbish. Then the principal would say, no. You are all rubbish. I'm representing the state here. That scenario, you know, I'm thinking of those. What? Can you just throw some light?
Just
I think it is very important that just to, on the draft thing, just to, before I answer the question, just to add another thing also for the members to consider. And that is that we are busy here with our amendment legislation. It is just focusing on one small aspect and not taking into account what is contained in the other portions of the legislation. Section 20, Section 21, all those are not drawn into it. So it is, when you consider it, you must look at this in conjunction with the others. See, on the question, it must be remembered that the principal is a state employee. State employee is governed by protocol, governed by conditions of service, and is governed by the legal framework provided by the act within which that person has been appointed. And just, it is also very important that any public servant must adhere to the prescripts and the instructions and decisions made by his or her principal. You don't, as a bureaucrat, it is not your situation or your position to decide if you could make a better decision. It is your responsibility to come and execute the decision and implement it in a way which is contributing to the organization. It's a normal principle in any business. And if you can't do it, then you must get another job. But you cannot take the role of a decision maker because you don't agree with what your principles decide. And that is the rules that's applicable to me, it's the rules that's applicable to the director general, and it's the rules that's applicable to the principal. We're all on the same basis. And it is not only in the public service that you will find it, but also in the private sector.
Back to the olden days. The problem with the olden days is that the rules of the game were such that some of us, we had nowhere to go. So it was the hard way to use that rule. Fortunately, currently, the Constitution is there to cover both the SGB, the school, the principal, and that one. And the difference between the principal and other members, remember, everybody at that board has been elected. is only the principal who is there by virtue of being a principal. And that's what makes this difference. And I want to repeat this. Everything that principal does in that SPP should be flowing from the, in this case, from the headquarters, from the MEC, from whatever. Whatever he is doing is something that is flowing from that. That is flowing up to where he is. It could be, the SPP is not comfortable with that. Could be. And the SPP has a right to take up arms and say, how dare to do this. But the poor principal, what he is doing is something that flows from a national policy, from CM, from MEC, from head of department to him. Therefore, if the SPP, which is a secular body for me, has something to do against it, it is the right of the SPP to say, when you say MEC, actually say, you rep of the MEC, you rep of head of department, you, this is all nonsense. We are taking you to court. But when that happens, surely the principal cannot cross over and say, in this particular case, I understand. Even if he feels that is problem, that is all nonsense. The truth of the matter, that nonsense is his. All he has to do basically is, if he feels this system and policy is bad, it's not enough, yes it is. All he has to do is to resign and become not ordinary teacher. And as part of SDP, he's not a principal. He's not a member of SDP. He canvasses and campaigns and leads this SDP to court. Let me hear when you have a coming to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to ask from the department whether it would be possible for the principal to excuse himself or herself when discussions around the issue that would implicate the department, so that the principal should not be like a potential witness during the discussion around the SDG. I just want to check whether it is possible for him or her to excuse himself or herself from those events.
Yeah, Ben, do you want to respond to
that? Yeah. He is a secretary position, and which says that if there is a conflict of interest, that's personal interest, then you can excuse yourself. But when you are busy dealing with your job, that is your responsibility to be there. And you must deal with it. It is very often that you would find people sitting in two different structures with opposite interests. But you must still deal with it within the framework of both interests. You can't just lean towards one or the other. Many of the difficulties existed as a result of the messy position that exists. So what is the role of the principal? What is meant by those two words, professional management? And it was not spelled out. This is an attempt to address that. And if it means that a principal who is only one member out of 13, and big school, smaller school, slightly less, in a governing body, 13 to 15 members, it is one person who can only carry one voice. The others can outvote him or her, they can go ahead and deal with it. And that principle can, what we say here, you can fully participate, you can raise your voice. But when it comes to the actual driving of it, you have your responsibility as the principal, who is the representative or the delegated authority of the state, and you are by law on the other side when it comes to a challenge. And therefore you must also give evidence to the other side, because you are one of the managers. And it is therefore not a matter of interest or conflict of interest.
I love that.
Yeah, that explanation is
sort
of stirring some light, because your example was of a manager. and an employer and the responsibility. But your example wasn't of a manager stroke governor. So my thoughts were that maybe we're just thinking too in the lines here and not maybe considering that we've got a different animal here. We have a manager stroke governor, and perhaps we need to look at it in a slightly different way, because I mean, everyone's trying to box the position into a certain thing. Now, you've got communities and parents who expect to have a say in terms of who the principal and teachers are in their schools, because of their kids that they are handing over there. And so they expect, and they also have big expectations of that principal, and that principal must protect the, and promote the school's best interest, and that, so they see that principal as theirs, you know, as their front and protection and whatever. And governing bodies are not always skilled people. They're really helpful, well-meaning parents who want to do their best but are not all that equipped. And so they put a lot of expectations on that principal. And perhaps the principal is being put into a very awkward position, because it seems from some of the feedback that we've been getting that there are situations in the province where departments put schools in very difficult predicaments, and that they have to be challenged if that school is to survive or to actually not be disadvantaged. And to expect a governing body that, if their strength of sitting in their principal, to expect them to not have the leadership of that principal is very difficult. And I'm just wondering if there isn't a way that we can go back and just re-look at this, because are we really saying that we want to prevent somebody from telling the truth? I don't think that's what you want to be saying, but that's what's sort of coming out of here. Are we saying that we want to protect the state beyond what's reasonable? Are we trying to give people the impression here that we're closing in, we're protecting the state, that there could be no questions, that people are going to be muzzled and there's no evidence? Do we want to see conflict between the school governing body and the principal? Because now the principal is the defending creature that you say. And of course, if there's conflict, do we want to just not deal with it? I mean, if there is a situation where a school is seemingly being disadvantaged by provincial departments, that conflict must be dealt with at that time. I mean, we mustn't obviously now assume there's going to always be conflict between the department and the school governing body. There shouldn't always be. But if there is, that principal is in a unique position. And I'm just wondering if we've captured that enough in what we wanted to say.
I think what personally is quite a bit here, but certainly there's quite a lot of concern about the general understanding of the cross, especially the way to the population. Because what the cross states, you know, is the implicit relationship in terms of labor laws, contracts. So what I was asking is it possible to link this thought with some very critical cogent issues that bear out that contractual relationship, which did allow the principal from giving evidence against the issue of this position. Bring in that link so that any ambiguity entertained by other people
on the
technical thing, just on something completely different
that
I just wanted to mention. And that is that if you look at 16A1B4, that is line 31. It says there that there must now be a plan, and the plan must be approved by the head of the department, and then there should be a report on progress by 30 June. But in sub 3, it says that the head of the department, they approve that, for internal. So, you know, one time for the situation for interfere. He returns it on the 25th of June, and now, according to this legislation, by the 30th of June, there must be important progress. So my question is just whether we shouldn't add there by Kansas, for example, by 30th June or such other days determined by the to make progress, to make provision for negotiation where the plan is not approved, it's returned, to make then provision for later report in the program.
The applicant is funding.
Thank you. Okay, just on that latter item, probably that ability is keeping the door. I think you propose already the submission of the plan should be determined. So it probably is illogical to say any subsequent steps should also be on an active version. So I don't think Chair, look, on the other matter, I think you go around the wrong principle. Clearly, a lot has been said. It is an issue on which there could be both misinterpretation, deliberate and otherwise, let's put it that way. It's easy to make the case here that principles are being gagged in some way. I think it's our responsibility to make sure that it's well understood that the qualifiers in this clause around the conditions under which a principle may not give evidence. And also, of course, understanding that the whole thing opens with unless the court of law directs otherwise. So clearly it's a situation where it does seem appropriate, as the Honourable Member said, for the court to hear the truth, if that's where it can come from. Clearly the court of law has that ability to then request that. Yeah, we will look at the issue of then just proceeding it perhaps with something like in accordance with other provisions or other applicable legislation, the principle may not, if that does not to explain it, perhaps we can work with the community.
In order to assist that, I don't know if the indirect is here, the fed up to 16.3. Are there any other clauses in that which could assist? Well, say, this group that we are referring to, how important is saying? Oh, you have to look at this clause and it's going to jump up and south. This out is referring to this other. Is there any other important clause other than that 16.3? Because all what we're doing here is to enhance, is to just implement something that is there already. Maybe don't answer now.
I'm
trying to see where you're trying to fix this so that people can repair, because if I say this invokes a lot of debated funds, and I think basically it means you can't understand it. When in aquaculture, the truth of the matter is the principle in the SDG represents community. The principle in, I'm constantly using this example, that there was a crash in conservation 69 that is not the problem of the SDG, it is the problem of the principle. Of the head of department of the MC, because it is not a board of directors where the bug ends yet. It does not end, the bug does not end with the FCP. It ends with the government. And the rest of the national MC is the. And if you go to see again in that previous category, obligation, it says on page 7, that's C. The principal must assist the government body in the performance of its function and so on, but should such assistance or participation may not be in conflict, reading C, with any obligation that he or she has towards the head of the department who is putting it here. He has an obligation, he is mandated to do ABC, the members of the executive council, who he is representing, where any one of them or may be cited in any legal constitution. Because when all those people are cited, they are cited of something that happened in that crew. They were not there. And the only person that was there in that crew was that principal. Which basically means if you cite the MEC, you are citing the principal. Otherwise, we would cut the tie. The principal, we are there, run with the ball. But the principal must die. Okay? Now, that little piece was there in that car that was not licensed, blah, blah, blah. As long as we have that understanding. Do we cross over to 9 now for now? So we cannot have norms and say they should not be attached. All this is just putting some piece that when we have these norms and things, something must be happening. Head of department do something, blah, blah, blah. All those. Unless you still have this problem of this head of department, they have proofs. Can I think we have no comments or questions or such on close mind? Let's go to access peripheral cross again. Yeah, Ben, can you refresh us with the relevant reference? Because there's the concern there. Well, that is an unfunded mandate. We don't have this auditor. Not only is it unfunded, we don't have this auditor out there in Cambodia. Can you say something so that we are not. I'm referring here in that clause.
Okay. Yeah. Actually, it is very important that this is an amendment to subsection 1 of section 43 of the Schools Act. It is very important when you read that, it must be read in conjunction with what is contained in subsection 2. Of that same section. It is important that this is actually a technical amendment because the original legislation which was dealing with accountants or auditors has been amended and it is now just an updating of the new law or this piece of legislation to the new law that is now governing that profession.
I'm assuming that everybody has this document, Savas Food Act. This is document, Savas Food Act. We are referring you to search to the clause 43 of this document. There are copies, this is all there. There's a big copy.
Section 43.2, and I'm going to read it. It says, if the orders referred to in subsection 1, that's the one that's now been amended, is not reasonably practicable, the governing body of a public school must appoint a person to examine and record on the record or and financial statements referred to in section 42, who A is qualified to perform the duties of an accounting officer in terms of section 60 of the Close Corporations Act, that's only what is known as accountant, or is approved by the MEC for that purpose. So if there is not even an accountant available, then the MEC can, for instance, use a accounting teacher in another school to do the auditing in another school. It is just to deal with skills. And it opens up a lot of flexibility, and it is, in any event, what is the reality in our schools is governed by this provision in many cases.
Are we changing that accounting in that one that we're changing here? In the one that you are reading, it's still referring to the accounting office. Is this the one that we're changing? We're not changing in this new language.
No, dear. What we propose to change here is an amendment to section or subsection 1, which was dealing with also auditors, but auditors in terms of an act of parliament that has since been repealed. And we are just now linking the auditing, or the source of auditing, the new act, and clean up our legislation in order to reflect the
I'm assuming that we have no more questions, comments on that. That was our clause 6 across again. Clause 11. Identification of underperforming schools. You need to know this. And I think the first round, this ball was put in the court of SCPs. Now it is back and head of department. It is the head of department that must say, you school B, you have not met the national curriculum statement standard.
People were referring to an issue where written notice was issued to the school and not the governing body, but it appears that it's sort of implying that the governing body must still deal with it, and there was some understanding that a lot of those issues would indeed issues of governance but issues of managing. Does that come under B? Can we just perhaps have that?
Yeah, I think there was also a misunderstanding as to what is the school and what is the legal entity and who is representing the school. The school act provides that the school is the legal entity. That is the one who is by law charged with the power to act on any function provided in terms of the legislation. And as a legal entity, which is a lifeless entity, it is the functions are performed by functionaries. And in the school act, we've got a partnership approach, where some of the functions are done by the governing body, and some are done by the department. And once again, it comes back to the principal, who is the representative of the department. The chair, the notice goes legally to the entity by law, and that is the school, and it will address the issue, which will either be a professional management issue, where you would find that the issues to be considered by the head of department will be to deal with incapacity with the principal and to assist it in that process. Or it can be as a result of a governance issue where, for instance, the purchasing of a learning material being assigned in the terms of Section 21 to the governing body, and they don't have a budget for that. Then it is a function which is done by the governing body, and it would mean that the steps to remedy is either to put the governing body on notice and withdraw the function as is provided in Section 22, or to provide assistance if they fail to perform it through a administrator in order to do the job on their behalf and to build the capacity while that is being done. But, it is not the interpretation, or there's no way in the school act that I know of where it says that if you address it to the school, it must be to the governing body. It depends on the function in the partnership concept, which will determine if you address it to the principal or if you address it to the chairperson of the governing body.
So can we assume, are you saying that the department then makes that decision and they will either address it to the governing body or the principal? I'm just wondering if it's clear enough here as to, because obviously somebody needs to be responsible for the plan or whatever that needs to be done. And I'm just trying to ascertain if it's actually very clear that people will know who's got to be addressed and who's got to provide them.
That is, the head of the department does not obviously identify the mischief and what practice is going to be addressed. And it is run through a specific intervention, and the attention of the legislature through this amendment is to draw the attention of the head of the department also to various options available in actually addressing the mischief. And it is not aimed only at the governing body, or at a principal, but it is aimed at both. and that is what you find on page. Yes, I can just hear the reference there is the on page 8 in clause 58B, sub 5, it is in line 13. It says, without limiting the nature and extent of the steps contemplated in subsection 4, the head of the department must consider A, implementing the incapacity code, that's under the educators and the principal, B, withdrawing the functions of the governing body in terms of section 22, or C, appoint a person in terms of section 25 to perform the functions specified. Or specified function of the governing body. So here it is very focused.
Is AC compliant with norms? I'm crossing to clause 10. I'm supported by my daughter. And the last thing was the general access to get to do it in forest. I think it's only sour which was good. I think there was a misunderstanding in there. So the school, the department said, I'm not going to pay. But my understanding was, if the school pays for in forest, surely they must get something out of that. You cannot have the school paying for them, when the chips are down. You say you forget about that contribution. You say department pays. All is saying, if you did contribute, surely the employer must come into the game. That takes us to court clause 13. That is our national financial aid, all we are adjusting here. All we are doing here are saying we are widening the scope, no longer on higher education. I think another group of the year there's something to say. No, not yet. Not yet. So we're all here with 13, let us spread the case. Clause 14. We're here because this to be applied into the other psychology. Clause 15.
Yes, Chair. Just a small amendment. That is in line 25, 15B. It reads there the substitution in subsection 3C for subparagraph 6. We want to add another subparagraph 5. So we would like to say, first of all, for subparagraph 5 and 6 of the following subparagraph. So that's the first one on page 10, line 25, for subparagraph 5 and 6 of the following subparagraph. Then we are saying in 5, in bracket technicon, close bracket, University of Technology Principles, that is 5, and then 6, in brackets higher education, we are saying further education and training college principals. So if you see the further education and training under 6 and higher education, we are removing that and higher education and putting higher education in brackets in front, and saying further education and training college principals. We would like to submit that and, you know, leave that for Friday, and if there's any further technical reformulation that needs to be done, we can perhaps just ask our advocates to do that. But that is what we are proposing.
in simple language, if you look at that 6, just look at that 6, that commence with that 6, it will really spread the education and training according to the principle.
And I just wondered if you could just say why, if it would be helpful.
All it is doing, remember, this NFS were not included in 2018, so I added.
Yeah.
And we no longer have those higher education colleges, and we're taking them up. So we don't have higher education college principals as part of when they are there. And the special education colleges are there, we're adding. That takes us to clause 16. Clause 17.
Yep.
Clause 18.
Yep.
Clause 19.
Yep.
Clause 21. Clause 22.
Yep.
23.
Yep.
24.
Yep.
To remember, 24 it is covered, that's for those auditors. If you have a problem with that question in 24, refer to that clause. 25?
Yep.
26?
Yep.
I don't know if that's here, but not here with us. Isn't it? Now, we comforted with the clause 26.
Yeah.
And the short title?
Yeah.
Am I allowed to start gender with this? I'm told those who are hungry will be fed at the new wing.
New wing.
New wing, the very get to life.
Neck of land, come
back. Okay. Leg of land.
Thank you, bro.
Let me say nothing. Thank you.